You're listening to Extra Time, driven by Continental.
How are you feeling after that, Matt?
I feel a lot better than Bob.
Extra Time is exactly how I find out what's going on in the MLS.
Get lost. Get lost.
Maybe this podcast has influenced me a little bit as well.
You guys are the experts. You'll probably have to analyze that.
Everybody up here, every single day, goes into the office, into the laboratory, to try to cook up some great stuff for you guys.
That's why he's here!
Oh, from Kansas City, Missouri, you are listening to Extra Time, driven by Continental. From my basement, I'm Andrew Wiebe with my partners in soccer, David Goss, Matt Doyle. Happy Thursday, boys. Happy Chris Armas, the Toronto FC day after. We have Chris Armas coming up on the show. We're very excited about that, so stick around. Also, there is a new crest, a new color scheme, a new brand in Montreal. I hope I said that right. Quebecois, come at me. Just drag me. Please, just drag me.
You were even close.
Yeah, that's unfortunate. I'm still working on that. Still like the kind of guttural sound there. I don't have it yet, but we will talk to the president and CEO of what was formerly the Impact, now CF Montreal, Club de Foot Montreal. Kevin Gilmore. We'll talk about that new brand and what's going on there, what the last year was like, and what he thinks of the year one of Thierry Henry. But first, it's the producing Anders reminder of the day, and this ought to get you groaning off the jump. It finally happened. All caps, Kellen Rowe is a Sounder. Do you have a thought? Do we want to leave it there? Free agency
signing? I sent this to Anders the moment I saw it come through, and he responded back with all caps. I think this was yesterday. So I've already felt that energy and that excitement from Anders. And I'm there with him, man. The resurgence of Kellen Rowe back home. He's probably going to get like seven dogs, become part of the crew, and they're all just going to like cruise around Mercer Island, I assume on lowrider bikes. It'll be a thing.
I mean, it sounds fun to me. Also, I think Anders promised. I don't know if it was a promise so much it was a blood oath in the production meeting here that he was going to get a Seattle skyline tattoo on some part of his body. So please, Sports Viking is his Twitter handle. Go hold him to account. Make sure that producing Anders does what he's supposed to do and inks himself for all time.
Neck tattoo for Anders, I think.
Neck, you think?
Yeah, in fact, we should run a poll. We should run a poll to see where the fans want Anders to get a Seattle skyline tattoo.
Exactly, the location. It's got to be visual. And if it's not visual, it's got to be right on the buttocks.
Really? Wow. What do we think happened to Kellen Rowe over the past 3.5 years? Because he was good for like the time he set foot in MLS until 2017, that Gold Cup. He was really, really good. And then for whatever reason, he got sent home after the group stage. And it's almost like he hasn't been the same player since. Like, I thought this guy was like a borderline all-star for a couple straight years.
And there was a chance there that he was going to kind of make a transition and push into the national team via sort of like an out. Remember, he was like going to be an outside back. And he had some he had a couple good performances, but it was at least like, maybe he gets a sniff.
That group stage, he was a winger.
Yeah.
And that's where he should be. The central midfielder or a winger.
Mm. Yeah.
I was in my Bobby Warshaw mindset
signed a
right
bunch
there.
Of people. And they were like, well, he can play left back, so he can do anything.
Right.
Then he never played. And then I think KC, he was hurt for a large stretch of that time. And then I think he was on 3 teams in like 4 months at some point.
Yeah, it was an RSL, and KC, then the Revs.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
All in 1 year.
Anyway, he's 29, and there's still talent there. You know, so this is the exact type of flyer that you would want to see your team take if they're an MLS Cup aspiration having team, which is obviously what the Sounders are. And I don't think he's there to start, but he's there to soak up minutes on probably either wing and central midfield, because they're gonna, like, Seattle's going to lose Jordan Morris for a good chunk of the year on international duty. So whether it's left wing, right wing, central midfield, he'll be, you know, I think he can give them adequate minutes. It seems like a good signing.
This show has started with a bang. The other thing I want to, again, we really need to find a way to get producing Anders like commentary in the chat on the screen, because in regards to the tattoo conversation, he writes, no regerts, N-O-R-E-G-E-R-T. So no regerts on that one, Anders. Good stuff, man. Good stuff. Okay, we're going to get to Chris Armas in just a second. We have some trades to talk about. Michael Barrios over to the Rapids. And, of course, Sueño, Jorge Villafaña, is going to the Galaxy, plus the mailbag. But I do want to remind people as well, before we get to this conversation, which will come in just a little bit, that the MLS Super Draft 2021 presented by Adidas is going to be on January 21st. That is next Thursday. It is streamed across all MLS platforms. You can watch the first round on Twitter, Facebook, YouTube, the site, and the app. Pluto TV as well. We are streaming the first round live. I'm going to host it. Matt Doyle and Charlie Davies are going to be there to provide commentary. Devin Kerr will have interviews as well with draft picks as those happen. So remember, 2 p.m. Eastern, January 21st, that is next Thursday. Figure out how you're going to do this, how you're going to watch it, how you're going to follow it. You can do it anywhere you get MLS content, so keep that in mind. We will talk in just a little bit about who the best Super Draft pick of all time is. I know we feel very passionate about our choices. We also feel very passionate about how we are going to make those choices and what the parameters are. But let's start with something that seemed to be sort of like the writing was on the wall. It was just a matter of time. Chris Armas to Toronto FC. He is officially the head coach on this Thursday. He is being introduced in the six. There have been mixed reactions to this, and I think in some ways that's natural as a Toronto FC fan when you look across and say, like, our sort of not rival but our compatriots in the Eastern Conference, this was their coach, and in the end it didn't work out, and now he's our coach. But ultimately you have to remember what Chris did accomplish with Red Bulls, and also what he wasn't able to do because of the unique situation that is the New York Red Bulls and the Red Bulls system. So I want to start with you, Dave, because you know Toronto FC sort of back to front. You are an honorary Canadian in some ways. I mean,
I'm
you're
trying
all
to
about
push
Canadian.
That. If anyone knows a way,
dude.
I'd like to
be
honorary.
You're all about that. Uh-huh. Oh, yeah. Make it official. Yeah. Give yourself some options. A little dual national flavor for you. What do you think? Chris Armas to Toronto FC.
The way the whole process worked out, the way it ended up coming about, it didn't feel like this is an organization that knew Greg Vanney was going to leave, and their home run was to get Chris Armas and to get him in the door and get it done. The way this process has played out, the number of interviews they've done, the length of time it's taken, the fact that he was so deep with DC United, all those things. And I think you can feel it from the outside with the club, the way the reaction from the fans was. And I think the way the club kind of is saying, like, almost forcefully, like, no, this is our guy. We promise this is our guy. But one of the things we know is Ali Curtis wants to put a stamp on this team. He wants them to press a little bit more. He worked with Chris Armas, of course, in New York and was able to get that franchise turned around and all those things. And the other thing we know is this wasn't a Toronto FC front office that was looking for the big personality to take over and be the face of everything. And Armas isn't that guy. And I think he has great soccer ideas. He's a guy that people were trying to hire as a head coach in MLS before he even really coached at all. He had to turn down multiple jobs because he was ready to move back to New York for a little while when he retired playing. And he's a guy that everyone across U.S. soccer sphere and Canadian soccer respects as a soccer mind, his passion, his detail, all those things. There's a lot that went on in New York. I think he got lost going from Jesse Marsh to how do I make this team a little bit mine while still having the DNA that we need? And at the same time, he lost three or four top whatever players at their position, Tyler Adams, Sasha, BWP, Robles, all those things as he was trying to do that. And so it didn't end great. At the same time, replacing Greg Vanney is fairly similar in Toronto. So it'll be interesting to see what he's learned from his past job. But I think for Toronto, they have an idea of combining the beautiful soccer they've played over the last few years with more high intensity, more high pressing, getting younger. And I think Chris Armas fits into all those ideas.
I agree with what David said. There are a lot of connections here, right? Chris Armas and Ali Curtis are obviously, go back to the Red Bulls. Chris Armas was on that great Chicago Fire team at the turn of the century, and that was coached by Bob Bradley. And you know who was at every training session? Michael Bradley. So having that relationship with the team's captain right off the bat probably matters quite a bit. So, and the other thing is, I think Bill Manning was probably instrumental in this hire as well. And I didn't realize this, but Bill Manning and Chris Armas were teammates on the Puerto Rican national team in 1994 World Cup qualifying.
They're also both Long Island guys.
They're also both Long Island
guys. Deep Long Island guys.
Yeah. So just in terms of having from the players to the coach to the front office, that type of integration, I understand why fans are like, why did we end up with Chris Armas? He didn't really improve the Red Bulls. In fact, they got worse under his watch. But you also understand why Bill Manning and Ollie Curtis made the decision that they've made, given his deep knowledge of the league, his deep ties with the league, and also that 1996 LA Galaxy pedigree, just like Greg Vanney, you know, keep bringing those guys to Toronto, worked last time. So, but it's, I mean, I don't think nobody's sitting here saying this is a home run. This is the obvious pick for Toronto FC. Armas is going to have to prove it. And this isn't the type of team where you get a year to feel it out. Like, Toronto's window for winning more trophies is now. It is immediate. So they're going to have to come out the gate real strong. That's going to be on him. And it'll be interesting to see, you know, how Red Bullsy they are in terms of their approach, because I don't think they have the personnel to press, what type of formation they have, or they go out in, because I don't think they have the wingers to play a really effective 4-2-3-1 or 4-3-3. So there are, even though this is a really good team and a really good roster and almost won the Supporters' Shield last year, there are a ton of questions that Chris Armas is going to have to answer real fast.
I think the most interesting thing about this is sort of that push and pull that happened at Red Bull with Armas from a tactical standpoint, where not only was it, you know, we were a big part of this too, of talking about, like, why didn't you stick with this? Why didn't you stick with what brought you there in that game against Atlanta in the playoffs? And it was kind of the push and pull, like you said, Dave, this is the way he sees the game, and this is the way the Red Bulls organization saw the game and thought it should be played, and it had been played under Jesse because Jesse was so deep into that world. Like, how does now Chris Armas, with a little bit of an opportunity to not have that obligation, to not have that sort of baggage from up high of this is the way we do it, we are dogmatic in a lot of ways about this, how does he set up his team? How does he try to play? Also with the roster, as you said, Doyle, that doesn't really match up in those ways. Anders, again, makes a point here. I want to make this one too, is that Greg Vanney wasn't obvious when he was hired. Greg Vanney was pulled basically out of that Toronto Academy. And it wasn't like home run.
He had never been a head coach before.
Right.
So, and I think if you want to look at Chris Armas and say, I'm going to erase the Red Bull thing because it was short in the end, it didn't go the way it wanted, and how many coaches in the world have we seen get an opportunity, it not go right, and then the rest of their career is completely different, I think it's fairly numerous, and Thierry Henry's getting that opportunity right now in Montreal as well. The one thing I'll say about Armas, which I don't know, and I still don't have a feel for him, we're going to talk for him, and maybe we'll get more this time, is I don't know what he was doing in New York actually was about principles. I think he looked at a team and said, this is a team that's won 2 Supporters Shield and has failed in the playoffs every year. I need to do something different to win a championship, which is the expectation. And I think a lot of it was maybe it wasn't explained properly. Maybe Red Bulls didn't want anyone else to know, because what does it gain them by having other people know what they're trying to do? So I think we pushed a lot of it on Chris, on his shoulders individually, on what he wanted and all those things. When in reality, we all knew the ceiling for New York Red Bulls when they got into the postseason. And yeah, a couple bounces go a different way. They could have won, and he could have stuck to that. But he tried to find something different, which is what's interesting with Toronto, which is this is a more possession-based team. So does his little idea or ability to add some pressing fit closer to what he wants than the heavy pressing team that he's trying to bring a little bit more possession to?
And
I think that's kind of one of the interesting ideas now of where Chris ends up falling.
There's also going to be something here where, not to say that the Rebels didn't have talent, but Toronto, you would say, it's not going out of limb here, in terms of top end elite talent, especially on the attacking side, they have more of it. And he said it, I think, in his like opening here with them, which is basically, we have more resources. Like, that's just fact. Like, it just is. When you have Pozuelo and you have Josie and you have what Toronto FC have built, there is more. I think it will be interesting to see how he manages that side of the game, because that was a side that Greg Vanney seemed to really thrive in, of like kind of that ego balancing, in particular when Jovinko was there as well. And I think that relationship with Michael will be huge. You saw the quote that Michael put out, which is basically like, hey, when I was growing up, there might not be anybody more influential on like sort of my career and my approach than Chris Armas. He knew how to push me. He knew how to take me aside. He knew how to help me grow at that point is like, he's a young player, a kid in a lot of ways. So that's a huge influence on Michael Bradley. And you also wonder what role Michael will have in all this, given the closeness of their relationship and his profile as well. We shall see what happens in Toronto, but it also depends in large part on these players. Like, let's not put it all on Chris Armas. Like, can Josie stay healthy and be productive? How do they find balance between he and Io? How do they stay healthy, which has been a huge question mark? And then how does he deal with, and we'll talk about this with Kevin Gilmore in a little bit, the obvious difficulties of this pandemic cross borders? I mean, these Canadian teams, they just have more on their shoulders, frankly, than do teams in the U.S. right now because of the way the logistics work. So there's a lot of question marks. There's a lot to prove for Chris Armas. And it's time to talk to the man himself. It's an AT&T 5G call to the field. Chris, welcome to Extra Time. How you doing?
Good to be right back to work here with speaking with you guys. But it's obviously a really special day for me today and exciting.
So you said right back to work, and I was going to start you along those lines. I'm wondering what a soccer junkie like you, who's been in this game for decades, day in, day out, was doing from, late summer until now. How were you spending your time? How were you dealing with that sort of, what? Let's be honest, a little bit of a loss it has to be?
I'll tell you, you know, it's I use the time wisely, but yeah, September, October, November, December. So it was too much time on my hands, driving my wife crazy. And I'm the cheesy old dad to my kids. So, but, you know, a lot of family time, even with my mom and dad who live about 45 minutes away. Always thinking about the next opportunity if there's a right one out there. And then, quite honestly, spending time learning, watching, thinking about my experiences in the past, how to apply it next time around, and touching up on some Spanish and reading and watching games. You know, it's obviously you start thinking about all the top teams out there in the different parts of the world. So it was good to analyze some different teams.
You mentioned a lot in there, your family. I know you're tied to New York, tied to Long Island. I know you really wanted to come back here when you finished your career and coach and all that. So what made this the time you were ready to potentially leave as you started to look for those next jobs?
Well, you know, the one thing to say is that in 1996, I moved from New York to LA as a player. So then it was 2 years out there and then 11 years in Chicago. So it was a long time away from New York. And then when the playing career was done and I spent 1 year coaching in Chicago, so that was 2008. You know, my children, let's call it into 2009, were going to, you know, be 8 years old and 4 years old, or, you know, going to 5 years old. So it became time for me with, you know, think about the life, and you all know it, like the life of a pro athlete coming and going, add in the national team. And I did that for, you know, whatever that was. It was 7 years. There was no off season. There's no real downtime. Your vacation time, your off seasons. There's a January camp starting right after January, you know, New Year's. So for me, it was really important to get home and be around my children, and there for my wife. So yeah, now we are at a different stage. My kids are 16 and 19, and we, if the situation was right, we were going to go and keep pushing, as I'm at this level. So this became when Toronto showed this interest, and you know all of that we do about Toronto, that organization, then you get to find out the inner workings of it and say, whoa, this is something special going on.
So we know you were also, at least per reports, interviewing with DC, or at least discussing with them. Toronto is the job. It's a great job. We all know that. We've all seen what they've done over the last couple of years. Walk me through, after you learned some things about head coaching and the role in New York, what you thought was important, what you were asking decision makers about when you were in interviews, what you were prioritizing for yourself in the next job, and how Toronto met those priorities.
Good question. I and, you know, when you asked me what I had been doing for this time post coaching in New York, it's a lot of reflection. Reflecting and just seeing all the ways in which I evolved or learned, and whether it's thinking about media or training and being specific and style of play and delegating and staff and coaching and in-game and preparation and game planning. There was a lot that went in that in my 6 years, call it, with New York, that you know, for the first three and a half with Jesse, it's a certain role. And all along, it was always the challenge of, can you think like a head coach? Jesse would say it to me. He would say it to me in training and in video preparation and all the time. And I'm not a guy that you need to say that more than once. So all the time I'm thinking, not only can I think for Jesse and pick up the slack in every way, but can I think like a head coach? So I was preparing, and then here you go. So now you step into that role, and it's a whole new ball game because it's, you are the voice, you are the leader. And probably the biggest thing is that you have to think of 100 things, it almost feels like, at once on any given day. And the way I was working, very similar to the way Jesse was working, that we showed up early, we left late, but we did a lot. You know, we work. We don't cut the corners. It's the young guys. It's the older. It's the USL. It's academy. It's bringing players up. It's taking care of people around us. It's making sure that we take care of that first team. And, of course, it's training. And after the game is before the game. You know, you're done with one, it's on to the next one. All in this rhythm. And then you get comfortable in that fast-paced rhythm. So I think the to really answer your question, because I know what you asked, you know, at the end of my time in New York, you know, and moving on to the next situation, no matter what, it was just going to be that when I'm searching for that right fit, I'm looking for a certain, certain, not necessarily resources, because that's secondary, but it is a certain, you want to be supported in a certain way, that whether you're their guy or that they, you know, it's really that became really important, that the next time around that I'm part of all those decisions to for roster and knowing that a club's going to be really ambitious to push certain things and do that collaboratively. So I think I found the right situation for that.
Do you think, Chris, that we saw sort of the true Chris Armas in New York in that head job? Like, do you think that maybe the perception that some people have of you from those days is true, or is that sort of a period where, as you said, in reflection, you maybe weren't able to or didn't have the resources or the support or whatever it might be, or the situation was just what it was, to really show exactly what you believe in and what you are as a head coach?
Yeah, I think that's a loaded question, because honestly, I think if I were looking for a head coach, I would be happy to find some of the qualities in some of the work that I did, because what was never really talked about were some of the challenges. So, and then people will throw the words success and failure around. They're words like what? And then you have to define it. So if it's just about, did you win the trophy? Then you say, well, most teams fail every year.
Yeah.
But what are the expectations? What was the expectations for the New York Red Bulls? Like, let's say in 2019, they're spending the third lowest in the league. That team should win the championship. Like, is that the expectation? Like, is so we end up having 14 wins that year, and we lose Tyler Adams and Bradley Wright Phillips, essentially, you know, and I promise you, life got harder. Without Tyler Adams, it put pressure on Kaku, it put pressure on our team. Yeah. Ask Berhalter, is life different with Tyler? Ask Leipzig and Julian Nagelsmann. Like, so that's not just, oh, they lost Tyler Adams. That was never really talked about, because who's going to talk about that? That's not, we don't have Tyler anymore. It's time to move on from Tyler. Figure it out is my job now. Wright Phillips was always seemed to be a guy good for a goal a game. Oh, but he's not there. So it wasn't talked about that we set a record that year for most amount of different goal scorers, with Tom Barlow, Brian White, the whole bit. But there was a narrative, guys, that and after the fact, you know, my video analyst says, Chris, let me share some data with you. So, you know, although some say you weren't where's the pressing gone? You led the league in balls won in the attacking third, higher than the previous years. Oh, really? I wouldn't have known that. So, but take out the emotion. So again, this is for others to go look at. Number one in the league in winning balls in the attacking third, despite facing the most amount of long balls. Oh, that's interesting. And in the mid block, most balls won in a mid block. Most amount of balls played forward in the entire league. Second in the league in things like the field tilt, which is the final third possession. First in playing balls forward. So are we not playing Red Bull football, or are we? Like, yeah, but no, but it's, is it like just analytically and statistically? So I think that folks on the outside got to see what they don't get to see is me as a coach on the inside and as a leader. And I will tell you that when you go along the way and it's not, you don't win every game, you know, we were in every game and we won 14 games. You know, I just asked on the TFC media, someone said something about 2019, TFC won 13 games that year, but they went to the final. We didn't. We were right there with Philly in a really good game in the playoffs, and we lost in overtime. So success, failure, I think people got to see some of the work that I did. I think, I'm proud of a lot of what we did. Certain things that, yeah, I mean, you wanted to, I would have loved to bring the trophy home in 18. It's a big regret of mine because I, for the supporters and for the players and their families and the organization and the people who show belief in me, that this was, is the greatest reward. We were right there. We were right there with Atlanta. And, but yeah, listen, along the way, the challenges were never really talked about on the outside. It was what's not happening, as opposed to, hey, there's some pretty good things going on here. And again, the stats that came my way, Chris, you actually had the second most wins in the Eastern Conference in your tenure. Really? Is that true? I'm not sure. But Atlanta and then New York Red Bulls and the sixth most points per game in the entire league in my tenure. These are just statistics that I presented even when you almost have to defend yourself in an interview, right? Like, because there's a narrative. But in the end, people, I think I'm excited to put my stamp on the Toronto FC player pool and the quality that they have in that locker room, the veteran players, the players that have just top-notch quality and leaders, and some really interesting young players coming through. So, yeah, it's really exciting.
I mean, that's what I was saying about perception, I think, is that there was a little bit of, like, nobody knows what's going on behind closed doors except for those that are there. And I appreciate your candidness, Chris, in that answer and sort of walking us through from your perspective how all that works. Dave, I'll step out of your way because I know you got plenty of questions. You know the Red Bulls. You know Toronto better than anybody else.
Chris, we've talked soccer a lot, and you've taught me so much, and there's so much we can talk about. And one of the things I realized was, in you taking over in New York, there was already an established philosophy and style. And I don't know, for me, and I think a lot of people from the outside, what is Chris Armas's philosophy of soccer? Because it was kind of already set some of the things you would have to do. So I'm just curious, blank slate, just the way you see the game. Is there a right way? Is there a wrong way? Is there a specific way you want teams to play?
Yeah, I would probably have to go back to 07. So the last year I played the game, right, competitively, let's call it 13 years ago. That's people who know me as a player. That's how I see the game in terms of, you know, let's just say with the ball, you know, I tried to play quickly. I tried to play forward. I tried to take care of the ball and understood, you know, finding Claudio Reyna, Cienfuegos, Peter Novak, that was the thing. So can I play forward? Can we play with tempo when we don't have the ball? My job was always taking time and space away. So then that's in the core. And then you start coaching. And of course, then I get introduced to a really interesting style of play, Red Bull football. But along the way, you realize, what is Red Bull football? I bet that if we talk to half of the coaches in the league, and coaches, critics, pundits, whoever, what is give me a little analysis of that. I'm not so sure people could talk about that, because then I'd say, well, tell me about Ralph Rangnick and Jesse Marsh. Oh, they play vertical. Well, how about Julian Nagelsmann? How about Marco Rosa? Well, that's different. They spread the field. They more possession. Then what is Red Bull football? So for me, to answer your question, I, like in my life, I see the game with emotion, and I see it with passion, and I see it with energy. That's the starting point. That's how I played the game, and no one can deny that, right? And that's how I see a team on the inside at the ground level. That's what it should be, because without that, I just – how can anyone connect to that, and how can that ever win out? So with that energy that starts formulating within players, and energy from a coach every day, and then I think the vision is that the fans can feel that they could be proud of a team that steps on the field and goes after teams. I mean, I never lost to Atlanta United. Could you imagine? Well, that's lucky. Okay, won derby matches. We put teams in real games. That wasn't because, oh, I just sit back and it's no coaching and it's look how good my it's we prepared, but we prepared to make things difficult by putting teams under the gun and by controlling spaces. So energy, that's infectious, and now you can now drop that into a style of play. So if you talk about with the ball, I do see the game being, you know, speed of play. And numerical advantages all over the place. Speed of play plus ones in buildup, in mid block, in by compressing, by having more players in the opposition, or specifically overloading certain areas that you can play quickly, and that you can play with overloads. So that's and playing forward. So verticality is how I also see it. You know, is there time for longer spells of possession? Sure, using the ball differently, defending a lead. Opening opposition, lateral passes, back passes. I understand the value of it all. Moving a pass to move the opposition. I get it. But I do see the game generally with emotion, speed of play, emphasis on verticality. And it's not necessarily to lose the ball on purpose. But that style of play starts to induce counterpressing. And again, it's not just from thin air, right? Because then you start to, as coaches realize, well, where do goals come from? Well, if it's true that 63% of all goals are from transition, then how do you create transition? You know, so I think then it becomes about when you have the ball by certain inducing it at moments. Some of it's direct play, some of it's by playing forward. So some of it's just by speeding things up, and it feels like transition. It's interesting. And then, of course, by good defending, by controlling spaces, by compressing, by controlling, by counter-pressing, then you can also create transition. So some speed of play, verticality, and then an intensity and organization against the ball. And ideally, playing high up the pitch, defending the midline, and causing mistakes, making teams uncomfortable, not letting teams – you know, necessarily have their buildups and be comfortable.
Is there a transition that's coming for this Toronto squad? Because in some ways, I'm not sure I always saw those attributes from this squad over the last couple of years.
So a transition in players?
Just style of play and the responsibilities that they're facing. I mean, I'm sure that you've watched and analyzed and gone through every nook and cranny of this roster.
The answer is yes. What I would say to that is I understand Toronto on a certain level by coaching against them and understanding really the player qualities and how Greg Vanney had them play. And they were the benchmark and are the benchmark. They play well. They are a good team and they have championships to back that up. What I would say is at this point in time, I think it's recalibrating what a good play is, recalibrating what a good pass is. A connected pass is not necessarily a good pass. Can we be more vertical when we have the ball? So more deliberate in certain ways when we have the ball. I think Toronto also emphasized speed of play, but can we keep that going and with a little more ideas to go forward and to play against the ball a lot more? You know, to to have more intensity when we don't have the ball. That we are, I think, in some of it is, it, you know, from what I you see is, and it's just what's in my brain for the game. It's just some of it's habits, some of it's urgency, some of it's pride of what it, you know, to give up a goal. Well, how much does this matter to us to defend our own goal? 57 goals scored, 52 against, I think, in 2019. Yeah, can I come in and put a stamp against the ball with organization and habits and creating more of a hunger to press and counter press? So, yes, an injection of intensity to each, you know, phase of the game, let's say. And so, for sure, transition.
I just wanted to ask to close you out on this TFC team. You're talking about those developments, things you can add, things you can take away. From a roster point of view, though, this is probably one of the least established groups we've seen. There are question marks on whether guys are coming back, on what the team will look like for the future. What are the needs for this TFC group?
Yeah, look, I think with Ali Curtis, Bill Manning, we've been talking, but to really delve into, you know, I'm coming into their process where they're at with some signings, hopefully maybe even big signings, but look, understanding where they're at is important, but understanding their strengths of a Jonathan Osorio, a Marky Delgado, Michael, these are intelligent players. They have these guys can play. Pozuelo, he's a gem in the league. But yeah, when I look at the roster, I think that there's a lot there. I think there's, and we've seen, again, if you went around, you know, there's outside backs that can attack. We've seen Justin do that for a long time. And now Richie is a revelation, Laria. So working with center backs that can, you know, it'll be pushing them to defend aggressively and defend high up the pitch. This is a big demand. But you know, when you talk about a guy like Omar Gonzalez, he's a pro, and I think he'll do what we ask. So to be, I think the passive defending can get us in trouble sometimes. So I think it's more aggressive defending and playing up the field. And yeah, so I think, look, what I would say is when you think about what the team needs, I think adding a little bit of team speed is going to be important. Another attacker that can score and create on his own. And again, the I think there's plenty of connectors and intelligent soccer players that the quick thinkers can make the game fast. And there's the thing you maybe love most is that there's a winning pedigree in that locker room. There's a winning pedigree. So for me, it's not revamping things. It's me coming in, injecting some of, you know, some intensity and energy in certain ways and details that I think are important. Because as I've said, I don't think winning and losing, the things that have win and lose, it hasn't changed over the years. It's each end of the field. But I also know that playing with a certain passion and honesty, unless someone wants to tell me a team in the world that wins without that, right, that you work and run for the team and you work for each other, and that togetherness is what keeps teams together when things get tough. So I'm excited to inject all that I know into the team from a playing style and a energy standpoint.
We're excited to see it, to see the vision come to life here in Toronto. A little bit of a new era, but a lot of the same faces, and a good opportunity to see what Chris Armas is about once again. Congratulations, Chris, on the appointment. We're looking forward to it. And I'm sure we'll talk to you real soon in this upcoming year.
Awesome, guys. Thanks a lot for having me. Appreciate it.
All right, big thanks to Chris for joining us. A big job in front of him. And one of the first things that we're going to be ticking off here in the next week or so is the MLS Super Draft 2021 presented by Adidas. Again, Thursday, 2 p.m. Eastern. You can watch that live streamed. I'll be hosting Doyle, Charlie there, Devin Kerr interviewing. We got the first round for you at 2 p.m. Eastern time next Thursday, January 21st. It is time to get the conversation started. We also did on the last show, in the mailbag show, but I want to talk a little bit more about history here because we love doing that. We've done it so much in the past year for obvious reasons. I was thinking about this and I had a hard time defining this and I still don't know how I will do it. Started working off the top of my head here. Who is the best MLS Super Draft pick of all time? The singular one. No, like, we being here where I'll call myself out, where you list like 18 guys, you're like, well, it could be that guy if we're going by this definition, or maybe it's this guy, I don't know. But I'll also list these five other guys because they could be in the conversation as well and just CYA your way through it. This is a reminder for me more than it is for you. Before we get to our picks, how do we define this?
do we say that 96 to 99 is eligible? Because it's the it's like the college draft.
It's not quite super draft.
At least it's not branded super, but there are some super players there. So just tell me, Doyle. I'll let you do this one.
So this is why it would actually be appropriate to weebie yourself through, you know, weebie your way through this one, because you could make the argument for someone like Eddie Pope from a non-super MLS draft. You can make the argument for someone like Chris Wondolowski, who technically was not part of the super draft. He was drafted. It was in the supplemental draft. But I think that we have to kind of follow the letter of the law here, and it's written on our rundown. The best super draft pick of all time. So I think we have to go with someone who is technically of the super draft. And then you can still continue weebying your way through this, because there are multiple ways to put it. Like, do you go with someone who was drafted and was instantly one of the best players in the league in their position, and but then was sold for a huge sum? Do you go with someone who is drafted really low, but then provided exceptional value at that spot and either became a great player in the league or was sold on to a European team? Do you go with someone who was just like the top pick and ended up being a great player for a decade? There are multiple different ways to
and does it have to be?
So I think,
does it have to be in MLS? Like, or are we saying bulk of accomplishments? Does, like, do World Cup appearances matter in this debate, or does it strictly come back to what you did in MLS? Because I've,
Jose Altidore is a perfect example of that, because for the first 2 years with the Red Bulls, he was a really good young player, and then he got sold for $10 million. I think any MLS team would take that kind of ROI on, like, the 17th pick overall is what I think he was. But in terms of, is he a better pick than Christian Roldan, who has started now and I think 4 MLS Cups, been a fringe national team player? He was the 16th pick. Which would you rather have if you're a team? Which would you rather have, you know, if you're a fan base? It's like, that's why this is a pretty good Barstool debate.
So the one thing that I would put in, though, is if you're a great pick, you can't be the obvious pick at the obvious spot. And so you can debate whether it's career in MLS, career outside of MLS. But to me, great draft picks are not the top 3 picks. Oh, now, totally. There's always context into all of this, which is, oh, no one thought this guy was going to be good. This team reached on them and they nailed it. Understood. But in reality, everyone knows who the top 10 players in a draft are, and everyone is going to take them in the top 10 spots.
You're just, this is salt because of Jason Tatum.
I was going to say, this is, so I'm like, I'm just hearing a Knicks fan just like have an emotional reckoning with their entire life. That's what I'm saying. It would be so obvious.
With the 3rd pick, the Celtics get Jason Tatum. The Knicks get RJ Barrett. RJ Barrett.
One thing is, class matters. When you go back and look through the draft, the 2016 draft was no good. The 2019 draft, Minnesota put together great players. That's credit to Minnesota, but the players have to exist. The other one is, if you draft one of the top 2 players at a top 2 pick, congratulations. You've done your job. You showed up. You did the thing everyone needed you to do. It's when you take a guy in the 2nd, 3rd, 4th round who goes on to be an all-star, a World Cup player, even a starter in MLS when you look through these. Even being on a roster in MLS 3 years later means you made a good pick at those spots. That, to me, is a great draft.
If you draft someone, a rookie who completely changes your team, completely changes what your team is capable of, I don't care if it's the 1st pick or the 5th or the 50th. That is a great
I completely draft. Agree. There are a lot of swings and misses.
The fact that there are ones who are the 50th out there means the person who's the 5th pick cannot be the greatest pick of all time.
No.
It can.
It absolutely can.
How? How can two players who had similarly equal successful careers, one taken in the 1st round, one taken in the 4th round, be considered equally the greatest pick?
You have to do the obvious sometimes. That's part of the draft, is that you have to get the obvious stuff right. Now, look, let's go back through these drafts. And you're talking about, hey, wait, 1 through 10, everybody knows. 1 through 3, whatever, whatever. Omar Salgado went number 1 overall in 2011. Like, that was a huge swing. You can swing and miss big time. You know, Abu Dunlady right
that
now.
That doesn't
you know,
have
like,
probably as much to do with drafting.
Okay, scouting.
That probably has to do with setup. No, that probably has to do a lot with what happened once you got there. And sometimes on the
Vancouver Whitecaps could have had Darlington Nagbe.
Like, that's not set up. You just chose the wrong guy. I mean, you could have had Perry Kitt. You could have had Zarek Valentin at four. You would have had an outside back in Vancouver for like 10 years. AJ Swords, you could have had a foundational center back at six. Like, you have to make the right decisions. And I'm also defending this because that is my choice is going
to. But Zarek Valentin was not a good draft pick until he got to Portland. Zarek Valentin was not a starter in MLS and was not considered good.
Okay, so that's, again, that's that better than Omar.
Where you ended up and how it happened. AJ Soares, great, started in MLS Cup. Haven't seen him since. And
I mean, his career ended because of injury.
Right.
Like, he was a really good pick. He was a really good center back in MLS.
And he started in MLS Cup. That's great. Nagby, if Caleb Porter doesn't show up in Portland and Nagby gets taken by Vancouver, is he the same Darlington?
We don't know. Now? But he would be, so I'm telling you, he would be better than Omar Salgado. No offense to Omar Salgado. But if you go through this draft, again, this goes back to you have to like make obvious picks or make the right pick in the top three. Like, okay, Omar's number one. We don't want to drag him. Things didn't go well for him being in Vancouver. A lot of players in that era in Vancouver, you're right. Circumstance was a real issue for them in those times. But like, go down that first round. Jahlil Anibaba is there. CJ Sapong is there. Will friggin' Bruin is here. Victor Estupiñán is there, which is a nice ETR throwback for those of you that remember Simon Borg's obsession with Victor Estupiñán. Justin Miram went 15th. And if you really wanted to change your team for the good forever, you would have chose Bobby Warshaw off the top. He went 17th in that draft to FC Dallas. Okay, let's get into it. I think we have some parameters here, at least how we see them. And it's fine to have a different sort of viewpoint than each other, I think. You just have to establish what that viewpoint is as you make your pick. So it is time for each of us, and we would love to hear from you at home as well. I know people chimed in on Twitter yesterday, who the best MLS Super Draft pick of all time is. That's capital S, capital D. Don't go trolling back for Eddie Pope like I wanted to do. Here it is. We're starting with you, Doyle, old man MLS. Sorry, I've been waiting to say that all show. Who is the best Super Draft pick of all time, in your opinion?
Omar Gonzalez. The 2007-2008 LA Galaxy teams were unreal bad, like just incredibly bad given the amount of talent that they had on the team. Omar was the third pick in the 2009 MLS Super Draft. He went right into the starting lineup. They made, I think, four MLS Cups in the next 6 years. They won three of them. They won two supporter shields as well. He was multiple time best 11. He was a defender of the year. And then in his mid 20s, they sold him for seven figures. Just check every single box. And then after coming back to MLS, he helped lead Toronto to a runner up in last year's supporter shield and a runner up in the 2019 MLS Cup. And in between that, I believe he won a CONCACAF Champions League. So like it's just every box you want to check from a draft pick, Omar Gonzalez has checked. He's not the best defender who's ever played in this league. He hasn't had the greatest career. I think Chad Marshall has that argument. He hasn't had the highest ceiling. I think either Eddie Pope or Aiko Parra probably have that argument in terms of like a 3-year run. But in terms of what you want from a draft pick, Omar Gonzalez did, like, he checked every box, and he was as important to LA success as Donovan or Keane or any of those midfielders, including Beckham, Sarvis, and Juninho. He was the rock for that team. And I understand David's point. There are other guys who you look at like, oh, it's better value at the spot, but nobody has ever given a team more in terms of titles and year after year performance than what Omar gave to the Galaxy over the course of his first 7 years.
Can we also in this moment, and you're absolutely right about everything you said about Omar, give props to Bruce Arena and the Galaxy front office to also, I believe in the same draft, right? Go get AJ De La Garza and create that center back pairing that they already knew worked.
They had Leonardo starting for a couple of years.
Okay, I tried to wipe the Leonardo
years from my...
They
basically did everything they could to not make it the center.
Please don't tell me, don't talk to me about Leonardo in this moment. Like, just let me remember the good days of like big and little Omar and AJ just out here doing their thing. But that's part of it.
Let me just make one more point, though. And I get Gossman's point about value picks lower in the draft, but to be a really good drafting team in MLS, you don't need to do anything aside from get your top 10 picks correct. If you're picking in the top 10, pick the right guy and then develop him. And there's no better example of that right now than the Revs. Andrew Farrell was a top pick. Henry Kessler was a top pick. Tajon Buchanan was a top pick. Brendan Bribe was a top pick. DeJuan Jones was a top pick. That's your defense. And they're a conference finalist. And they're a really, really good team. If you can pick in the top 10, take the right guy and develop him, you will be a good drafting team. And it doesn't matter what happens in the second round or beyond.
Dave, the best MLS super draft pick of all time. You're following up Omar Gonzalez. Where are you going?
I'm going to go with someone who didn't do it maybe for that club the whole time, but Jozy Altidore, taken in the second round of the 2006 draft, goes on, scores 15 goals as a teenager, the youngest goal scorer in MLS playoff history when he did it for the Metro Stars and the Red Bulls. Then he gets sold for $10 million, which changes the stratosphere of how MLS is viewed, what young players can do coming out of MLS, going overseas. And he proceeds to be the greatest center forward in U.S. soccer history. He's going to set a lot of records and end in the top five in goal scoring and assists and all these things, and hopefully even more if he can stay healthy. Then he comes back to MLS, wins MLS Cup for Toronto FC. I had him in my 25 greatest players in MLS history. If you draft a guy who is in that stratosphere in the second round as a teenager in a year in which no one around them really even gets taken or has any sort of success in their career, that to me is nailing it on the head. And Jozy Altidore is the greatest MLS super draft pick.
I can't believe that you didn't go with Shalrie Joseph. You really think if you were starting a team tomorrow, or we put you in charge of Austin, right? And their number one pick, you could either give him Shalrie Joseph's career or Jozy Altidore's career. Which would you take if you were running that team? And for those who don't know, Shalrie was a 14th pick in the 2002 Super Draft. Same Super Draft, by the way, the Revs got Taylor Twellman.
And Shalrie was taken earlier than Jozy by a little bit, but he was. I'm just saying, I think you could go both ways, though. Because if you sell a $10 million player, that could change a lot of things for your club of what you can do.
Which do you think Austin would rather get next week? Do you think they would rather have, because it's going to be Philip Mayaka, it better be Philip Mayaka. Do you think they would rather have Philip Mayaka be their Shalrie Joseph or their Jozy Altidore?
I think you want them to be Shalrie, but I think the league has changed. Because I look at it, and you brought up Christian Roldan. I think he's the second most important player in Seattle's history because he has started four MLS Cups alongside three different partners in central midfield. Because he's not going to Europe. He's not pushing for that. So they have stability with him and they're able to build around him. But the star that Jozy could be, you weren't getting out of an MLS academy or really the super draft at the time Jozy was taken. And I know New York sold him, but there's a reason Toronto FC brought him back to win MLS Cup. You weren't capable of finding a player of that quality, I think, at the time in MLS. You weren't going to bring that player in. So that's the difference for me in my mind. For Austin, they're going to sign three DPs from South America, which are in a different stratosphere than what was capable back then. So they don't need a Jozy to come out of the draft.
Weeby's muted.
Yeah, I was trying to open up a box. You'll see why in a second. It was very loud. I would also argue that Austin might just take Jozy Altidore because of, one, perceptions within Austin. Like, is there a better way to start your club than to have a guy who ultimately is going to be this huge star, an attacking player, be sold to Europe, start sort of a pathway, you think, in what your club could be with some of those young South Americans to establish a market? And also, by the way, now you get a ton of allocation money and you get to reinvest. So I don't know. There is a this or that, and you can let us know out there what you would want. Would you want a Shalrie or would you want a Jozy?
Also, TBD. If we're being honest, I know that this was still an option at the time and Celtic came in. Shalrie probably doesn't stay his full career if he's playing in MLS today.
Yeah. No, that's fair.
It's a good point. I'm just going to throw this up. This is what I was trying to get out. Because if we're talking about back in the day, you got that one? You got a little bit of this on the back? Yeah?
No, I've got a bigger legend.
Little MB16 on the back there. But what if also we just throw up another one, the white Metro Stars? I got the treasure trove. Should I put this around my home? I could go Michael Bradley. I think that is one. Ultimately, he was way down there. You made the point in the pre-meeting, Doyle, that he wasn't really rated. And yeah, he went to the Metro Stars. He went to his dad's team, but he stepped in. He became a starter at a young age, which really wasn't happening at that point. And then he was sold, not for the huge numbers we see now, but he went to Aaron Veen, and we know what happened from there. He immediately jumped in. I remember the 16-goal season. I remember the Fjord jumping, pole hitting him in the face, Germany, all the different stops. His career is unreal. I am going to go with Chad Marshall. You sort of teased it out there. I would have gone with Eddie Pope because Eddie Pope, to me, is that rock for those DC United dynasty teams, still arguably the best dynasty of all time that really helped them be who they were and set a foundation for Echeverry and all the attackers and the midfielders to have the success that they had. But if you look at Chad Marshall, he comes into this crew team that has a MLS best defender in Chad Marshall. And from the very beginning is essentially an every game starter and makes 253 appearances for the club over basically a decade, wins three shields, wins an MLS Cup, is a two-time defender of the year, is basically the best defender in MLS history on MLS merits of all time, probably should have the Defender of the Year award named after him. I don't care that you took him like with the second overall pick. It doesn't matter. You made the exact right decision for your club and a decision that a lot of clubs have biffed over the years. I mean, nobody else has got a Chad Marshall. There are a lot of incredible center backs in the Super Draft that have come out. I mean, you got to go back and look at the names, and you'll just sort of be wowed by it. I mean, we're talking Bocanegra and Pope and Omar Gonzalez, as you said, Beisler, Ryan Nelson, I thought about in this as well, though he was the fourth overall pick. He left on a free, which kind of, I was like, soured on me, but he helped DC win a title, and he was best 11. Greg Vanney, Parkhurst, Eichel Parra, Matt Hedges, Walker Zimmerman, to go a little bit more recent, Aaron Long, he's a different one, Miles Robinson. I mean, there are a ton of great center backs. There are none better in MLS terms than Chad Marshall when it comes to winning individual awards, which he didn't care about, clearly. He always poo-pooed it, never wanted to talk about himself. But more importantly, winning things for his club and being absolutely rock solid, consistent throughout, and coming back, by the way, from some major injuries in doing it too. So Chad Marshall, for me, is that guy. I think he's the best of all time because of what he meant to not one but two clubs ultimately. The Crew over a decade, the Sounders over 5 years, more than 400 games, MLS Cups, Supporter Shields, individual awards. He is like the definition of what you would like to get out of the Super Draft. To go back to what you were saying, Doyle, would you take Shalri or would you take Josie? Nah, you would take Chad Marshall because for the next 15 years, you're good, period.
But again, wasn't the second best player in his draft. Probably wasn't the third best player because Clint gets taken six picks later and Bradley gets taken in the fourth round. So I don't disagree with you because center back is massive. And of course, the Chad Marshall theorem, respect to Bobby Warshaw, once again, a first round draft pick. But how can you say they hit a home run when two players were better that were on the board that they didn't take? That's all.
Look, I understand what you're saying. I don't agree with it.
Fair. And hindsight's 20/20.
I understand what you're saying. I understand what you're saying.
They won an MLS Cup. Seattle won an MLS Cup thanks to Chad Marshall. That's fair. Although Clint Dempsey helped things in Seattle as well in a weird coincidence of this whole thing. But yeah. And look, do you want to hear some of my late round lovers?
Yes. Give me a late round. I'm all for that.
Okay. So
and where did first of all, though, hold on. Where did the late round lover
phrase? I don't know.
I've literally never heard that.
Yeah. You didn't need to do alliteration there.
Sorry, but I did it anyway. So the highest pick that I put on this list, 39th pick in the 2010 Super Draft, RSL took Chris Schuler, who wasn't able to stay healthy, but they were able to continue to be an MLS Cup contender after they lost Hamison and Olave because of Chris Schuler.
Chris Schuler reference, love it.
After that, you've got at the 49th pick.
Hold on, don't tell us the name. 49th pick, 2011. What's the team?
Toronto.
49th pick in 2011.
Joao Plata.
Yep. Who did nothing for Toronto, then went on to have a fairly good career for RSL, played for Ecuador, a whole bunch of stuff, was weirdly an international pick in the Super Draft. And then you've got in 2010 as well, the 51st pick, which was the fourth round.
51st pick. What's the team? Give me the team.
At the time, Chicago.
At the time, Chicago. I have no idea.
I'll give you a clue. He starts in MLS now.
Johnny Bornstein.
Sean Johnson.
Yeah, that's a great pick. Yeah.
That's a great shout because Sean Johnson has had like a really exceptional career as a goalkeeper and getting him at that level. What about if you go back to 2006, Kai Kamara? one of the all-time leading scorers in MLS history, was sold for a good amount of money as well. Has won, I think, a couple of trophies with over the years. And I think he was, about 10th, 12th pick?
Yeah, I think late first round. Here's something wild. And so the draft changes every – there's different amount of teams, different amount of picks. Sometimes it's called supplemental, sometimes it's not. 2005 non-drafted players is Bobby Boswell, Wando, and Jeff Laurentowicz. All three of them went undrafted the same year.
No, they were drafted in the supplemental
draft. Yes, but that year there was more draft picks than supplemental normally, and so it got pushed back and they didn't get called drafted or whatever the terminology was. So that's pretty wild year.
What's the best – I mean, we talk about Sporting KC and the foundation that they laid with Roger – I mean, you go through a lot of it. Roger, Chant, Beisler, Zusi, Dwyer. To go with the Revs you were talking about, I was thinking like, oh yeah, they have another top draft pick that they have sort of like helped elevate into what he probably could have been the whole time. Teal Bunbury. I mean, they have all these draft picks over those years that helped set the tone. What is in your mind the best draft of all time? Because I know you dug around.
So you brought up Michael Bradley. So the year that the Metro Stars took Michael Bradley, they took Seth Stamler with their first pick, who ended up being an MLS starter. Zach Wells, who not great, but stuck around the league. Their third round pick was Olivier Auchan, who scored, I don't know, 5-10 goals for Canada, played in Europe for a ton of time. Doyle, do you want to tell the story?
He hadn't signed with the Metro Stars, and they went on a preseason tour of, I think it was the south of Spain, and in a preseason tournament against a couple of Scandinavian teams. He lit them up. And then one of the teams, I think it was Odd Grenland, one of the teams came in with kind of a godfather offer. And that's why Olivier Auchan, despite being arguably the best player on that Metro Stars team in preseason, never played a game in MLS.
They then took Michael Bradley in the next round and Jeff Park in the final round, which is a pretty loaded draft, although the two best players didn't really end up playing for them. The following year, Chicago took Chad Barrett in the first round, Chris Rolfe, and Gonzalo Sigaris in the third round, like three picks apart.
So I don't think those are good drafts. I don't think there is anything. I don't think anything comes close to what LA did in 2009, getting Omar and AJ out of the same draft.
I have one.
Go ahead.
2010, San Jose took Ike in the first round.
Oh,
Justin Morrow and Bates were two picks apart in the second round. That
so
was
that
in
should have
MLS
been.
Best
that
back line
been.
For 10 years.
For a decade. Yeah, that's fair. Between injuries and a little bit of front office incompetence, it kind of fell apart. But, like, Ike has an argument as one of the best defenders in MLS history. I think he had the best three-year run. Morrow has an argument as the best left back in MLS history. And Betashore is certainly one of the best right backs in MLS history. That's a really good draft. It's a really good.
I mean, you have to go with the Beisler-Zusi draft. You're talking about a decade.
That's
You're talking about two World Cup players, best 11s, a defender of the year. I mean, that one's there too.
And if that draft, so Steve Zakuani goes first. Obviously, the god Mike Fucito goes fourth round to Seattle. Great, great draft for Seattle. Then DC actually took Rodney Wallace and Chris Pontius two picks apart in the first round and Brandon Barklage in like the third or fourth round. If Rodney had done what he did, I think in DC and Pontius had stayed healthy, that would be one of the greatest drafts of all time. The other ones that jump out, 2013, Dallas took Walker Zimmerman and then Ryan Hollingshead in the second round. And remember, he like took some time off and didn't really come. And then they got Kyle Zoback in the final round, which is legendary. Seattle in 2015 took Christian Roldan, obviously, in the first round. Tyler Miller in the second round, who didn't play for them, but is a pretty good MLS starter. O'Neill Fisher in the fourth, and then closed it up with Charlie Lyon, who's like been their backup for 15 years. And then 2019, Minnesota took Dane St. Clair, Chase Gasper, and Hassani Dotson in the first two rounds.
That is of recent vintage. That 2019 Minnesota Super Draft is, I think, is easily the best. Because Dane St. Clair was superb this past year. And Dotson and Gasper are both, you know, borderline national team.
Point is, you can get players out of the Super Draft. Next Thursday, January 21st, got to scout them right, got to have them in the right situation, 2 p.m. Eastern. We will take you through the entire first round. So
Mark it down in your calendar. Stay tuned Tuesday and Friday next week. Remember, programming note, Tuesday and Friday, Monday is Martin Luther King Jr. Day, so we will not be recording on that day. We'll do the full preview with Charlie Davies on Tuesday, and then we'll wrap up the Super Draft on Extra Time on Friday. So be ready for that little change in your routine next week. Let's
can
get
I
this...
close you out, though, real quick? On
oh, man, we could go hours on this, couldn't we?
2007, Colorado had an awful draft, but in the third round, they took Omar Cummings and Nick LaBroca, four picks apart, which gets me jacked. And for you, Weeby, New York in that draft, super late in the draft, they took Dane Richards and Ubi Paripovich. That is a stacked third and fourth round.
The amount of references that we've gotten in over the last 5-10 minutes or so, it really makes me happy.
I can't believe we had a Chris Shuler.
It makes
reference.
Me so happy. I love
Chris Shuler
it.
Chris Shuler was a
it.
National team starter if he didn't get hurt, baby.
Stop Except it. His it. Feet were way too slow. His feet were
Not
way too okay. slow.
Not all pre-injury.
All right, let's talk to Kevin Gilmore. He is the CEO and the president of Club de Foot Montreal. Had a chat with him a little earlier today about that rebrand, the new crest, the new colors in Quebec. Let's take a listen. We'll be back to talk trades. It's an AT&T 5G call to the field. We're going out to Montreal, to Quebec, and we're talking to the president and CEO of Club de Foot Montreal, Kevin Gilmore. L'Impact, c'est fini. Kevin, did I do that right? Did I get that right?
Yeah, well, you got to work on the French pronunciation of the team name now.
Okay, I will.
Club de Foot Montréal. So.
Club de Foot Montréal. I understand that R to E-A-L is a little bit difficult for our American palates here. This is a big change. By my memory, 1992, I think, it's been the Impact. You came in about a year ago. Why the rebrand? Why the change? Take us through it.
Yeah, so I started actually almost 2 years ago. Listen, I firmly believe that whether it's a business or a sports team, your brand has to stand for something and say something. And I asked a question to ownership, what was the reason behind the Impact name? And what they told me was that when Joey started this team with three full-time employers in a lower division, his goal was to have an impact on the sport in Montreal and in the province. And my response to him was mission accomplished, right? Because from there in 2012, the team evolved to Major League Soccer. And now Major League Soccer is taking more and more place on not only the national, but international stage as a league. And the sport, soccer in Montreal and Quebec has grown tremendously. Our academy is now the reference point for youth excellence in the province. And just this last year, we signed six players out of our academy to homegrown contracts. So my point to him was mission accomplished. And I said, would you be open to at least contemplating a rebrand that had a message more at the core of who we are? And he said, listen, I will listen to you guys. I will, if you want to come back to me with ideas. He said, as long as it's a fit and it speaks to me and speaks to who we are, I will look at it. So we spent a lot of time researching and we came back to him after, you know, we hired a couple of Montrealers to help us out on this. And we used our internal folks. We did a lot of research. We spent a lot of time talking about our brand, our club, our fans, our city, et cetera, and came back to him with something that really struck a chord.
Why do you think it struck a chord, and why did it strike a chord perhaps with you as well as one of the, you know, the key decision makers at the club leading this process?
So here's the way I see it. I look out on the field and I see 11 players. And in our case, it's probably the case throughout Major League Soccer, but in our case, we've got 11 players from different countries, sometimes different continents. They speak different languages. They practice different religions. But they come together as a community of one on the field with a shared common goal. And it struck me that, and this is my opinion, that nothing reflects our city more than that. You know, Montreal is 375 years old, founded by five different populations, three different languages. And today, we are an extremely inclusive, diverse, multicultural, and I'll expand on that, even beyond multicultural, city with 30 mother tongues. And so we've been welcoming, it's a city built on five populations, only one of which was not an immigrant population, the First Nations people and four others. And it's a city in a province that's been built on immigrants, people coming to the city for opportunity, coming to this country. And all have understood through us being almost defiantly different that we are French speaking and our French culture is important. That's been preserved for 375 years. And I look at that and I see our players that come from different countries and immediately immerse themselves, not only in our sporting culture, but in the culture of our city and our province. And I said, we're a reflection of the population. So as a professional sports team, we act as ambassadors on both a national and international level. And it's important for us to basically speak loudly to who we are. And this brand does that. You know, you'll see through logo construction and everything we've explained, both in terms of the colors and what the logo represents, what the name represents, that this is intended to speak to what the city is, who its people are, and what we are. And that resonated with me from the get-go and resonated with Joey and the ownership group immediately. So that's from that point on, it was just a question of finalizing everything and announcing it, obviously, to the world.
If you are listening right now or watching on YouTube, we'll have it up there for you on the YouTube side. If you're listening via the podcast, I encourage you to pause or open up a new window. Go check this out if you haven't already. I'm looking at it right now. We got a round logo. You have the arrows. I love Montreal. I love going there. One of my best soccer memories of all time is the CCL final second leg. Of course, it didn't end quite the way that any of us wanted to, but what an occasion that was. I was there for the first Impact game at home, actually. Estad Olympic as well, but you have the Metro link there. I see those arrows. I recognize that. I see the M's positioned around. It kind of looks like a snowflake to me. You, of course, have the fleur-de-lis, but blue is a little minimized here, and I see the black and silver really pulling out, and my understanding is that that's where you guys are shifting to more black and silver. So walk people through the actual mark, the color identity, and why it is that those things reflect what you talked about in that previous answer when it comes to what Montreal is and how you want to be about it.
So let's start with the logo, then we'll shift to the colors, because the logo, as you say, is you've got the round circle, and that represents basically the rivers that surround our island. The circle is basically the island of Montreal. And the arrows pointing in are an homage to the metro, which links this entire island together. But it's also arrows pointing in, showing people coming to this island over the last 375 years, choosing to come here, choosing to live here, choosing to raise their families here. The M's are obviously a representation of the city, but at the end form the core of the snowflake. So the logo speaks to Montreal iconography, but also to the movement of people to this island, to the welcoming of people from this island. And the snowflake speaks to the fact that we live in a harsh climate. It is part of our lives. We live through harsh winters. It is who we are. It defines us. And you know, everybody here, because of the makeup of this city, is unique. But we come together as a force of one. And that's what the snowflake represents, really. It represents the environment we live in, but the fact that we are all very unique and different individuals that come together as a force of one, whether it's on the field or as a community. In terms of the colors, it'd be too easy to say, hey, black is a really popular color. But black is actually very significant as it relates to this logo, because black, first of all, is the color. When you blend all colors, you get black, right? Black is also a symbol of success. Montreal was the financial hub of this country in its early years. And financial success is defined by being in the black, not being in the red. Montreal is known for its nightlife. The jazz clubs in the 1960s, where Oscar Peterson started his career, were known all over Eastern North America as you go to Montreal, you go to the jazz clubs, you go to Montreal, you go to the restaurants. The nightlife here is a big part of what Montreal is. And for lack of a better word, in Montreal, good things happen in the dark. So that's why black is our primary color. The silver is because, you know, we could say white is represents winter, but it doesn't, because winter is not white. Winter's only white and pretty right after a snowfall. What we live here, we had an ice storm years ago, which basically shut down the province for, I think, 2 weeks, right? Silver is ice. We live in ice. We live in a cold climate. We grew up skating on frozen lakes. So silver is a color that represents the climate more so than white. And blue is an homage to two things. It's an homage to our prior colors, our primary prior primary color, and the province of Quebec, which is why blue was an important part of our initial logo branding and colors.
So all the explainer, we get that on all of these rebrands, you can go through it. And of course, you guys have all those materials on the side if people want them. But ultimately, people look at it and they have sort of a gut reaction. That's just the way these sort of things work. And you obviously know that. You've been in this business a long time. And you have to look across not so far away in Chicago and see what maybe has happened to theirs. How much influence did maybe supporters or fans have in this? How sensitive might you be to reaction? How will you handle that whole process? How are you thinking about it?
First, let's talk about the reaction. The reaction, listen, we know that some people will be disappointed. Some will be hurt by this because anytime you say goodbye to something you love, it's hard, right? We'd like to think that because we're doing this, because we want to use the privilege we have of being a national and international sports team and an ambassador to the city, that we choose to carry the message of this city and its population and our fans in a way that's very strong. We hope that'll drive some acceptance and ultimately as much passion, if not more passion, for this brand than the Impact brand. In terms of consultation, we spent a lot of time talking to people. Now, Andrew, we didn't go out and say, hey, what do you think about a rebrand? The research we did with fans, with people at large, was we had a campaign this past season called Impact Montréalais, where we asked people, what impact has the club had on you? We asked people, what impact the city has on them, the club, what impact the city has on the club. We spent a lot of time asking questions. And a lot of it came down to that kind of that pride of who we are, that this club is something that represents this city and needs to do so in an even stronger and louder way. So we did speak to, listen, did we take the approach that Chicago's taken now, which is, hey, come on in? No. But we did. It's not like we sat four people in an office and said, let's do this, right? We spent a lot of time talking to fans. We talked to people internally here who had been in the organization for years, even before they came to Major League Soccer. So we sought a lot of input on this before we finalized everything.
Now, look, I love the black and silver from last year. I know that some people saw that, and I saw it on Twitter being like, not for me. It was for me from the very jump. I really enjoyed that scheme. I will be curious to see how you guys activate that in the years to come. But forget the marketing talk. Forget all that. I mean, the biggest part of your brand is what you do on a soccer field. So let's talk about that. And I have to start you with something that I think we all sort of understand in a very theoretical sense, because we weren't the ones that had to live it, which is, what was it like to be running a club in Canada, being a staffer at a club in Canada, being a coach at a club in Canada, being a player at a club in Canada during this pandemic where rules and regulations and everything else was so complicated, in particular for clubs in Canada? What was this last year like? Give me some like firsthand experiences here that just tested you.
Yeah, listen, it was challenging from the get-go because obviously, and I've said this before, I have two families that I take care of. I've got my personal family, my wife and three children, and I've got 150 people, including the players, that are my family here. And the first priority when this first started was making sure everybody was safe and we took care of everybody, players and staff and employees as well, in terms of keeping people employed and making sure we rode this through together. The challenge was that, and we can start at the beginning, was the uncertainty. There was lots of uncertainty. And then certainty came in little buckets. The MLS's back tournament, not really knowing what was happening afterwards, because it's not that we didn't know what could happen afterwards, it's that we had plan A, B, C, D, and E. And so you're planning for all five of those. You hope that plan A, which would have been return to play in market, maybe behind closed doors, but basically playing Canadian US clubs, would be plan A, and plan B, and plan C, and plan D. And so the certainty always came at a very late stage in the game, and it was making sure that players and staff, and that we were transparent with them and shared as much information as we could with them as possible to make sure that mentally they were prepared for it. Letting them know that our goal was plan A, but that there was a possibility, because a lot of things are outside of our control. We're dealing with federal government jurisdiction over immigration, over travel, over quarantine, provincial jurisdiction over health and safety, and trying to blend the two together in a context where there are far more important things from a general public standpoint going on was difficult. At the end of the day, I got to tell you, Andrew, it was unbelievably challenging and testing for our players, staff, and coaches that basically lived, you know, 3 or 4 months away from home. We played 3 games at home against Canadian clubs after the pandemic started. And after that, we were basically home away from home in New Jersey. And anybody that pretends that they could be told, hey, listen, you're going to do your job for the next 4 months, but you're going to spend 3 months away from your family in a hotel room. Anybody that pretends they could still do their job to the highest level is not being a realistic person, doesn't understand. You think the professional athletes, right, because they're professional athletes, they can handle it because they've gone through adversity and they're strong-willed and character. But human nature is human nature, and human beings are human beings. And it was wrenching for a lot of these players and staff as well, right? So I got to tell you, I can't imagine, and even Thierry said this, it's the most difficult thing he's ever experienced in his career. And he's been through a lot he's been through great clubs. He's been through unbelievable challenges on the pitch. It is the greatest challenge he ever faced. And I'm sure that every single player there will look back on this and say the same thing. But I look back as well, and I say that through this adversity, we still managed to do things that a lot of people counted us out for, and qualifying for postseason, and even our last game against Olympian Champions League, where they hadn't lost in I think 12 games, and we beat them 1-0, had to beat them 2-0 to advance, didn't, but that was a team made up of a portion of our players and a whole bunch of young players we had to sign because a lot of players left. So I'm unbelievably proud of what our players and staff and coaches did this year and what they accomplished. And to me, this year was not a measure of success as much as a measure of progress.
What do you think happens in 2021 for your group? And I want to combine that with another question, because we don't have all the time in the world here, which is, what did you see from Thierry this year, both as a coach and a man, and what do you expect from him next year?
Well, listen, interestingly, Thierry this year played several roles. He played the role of coach, father, brother. I mean, when you're with a group of people, basically isolated for that period of time, your role expands. And he played that role, and he played it extremely well. Listen, when I hired Olivier Renard over a year ago, it was because this club had never had a sporting director that wasn't a former player or coach on this team who moved up. Right? We'd always looked at our sport from the Montreal standpoint. We never looked at it from an international standpoint. And Olivier came on board after a track record of building successful teams with young players and being active on the transfer market. And we're not going to compete with the Atlantas by building a 65,000-seat stadium, right? We are going to compete in Major League Soccer by being a team. You look at Philadelphia, right? They've developed well, and they're active in the transfer market, and they're reinvesting in their young players. That is what we're going to do. Bringing Thierry here was part of that philosophy, right? To be able to attract players to come here. Louis Binks comes here because Thierry Henry's his coach. He can play under Thierry, right? And Louis Binks is a guy that's going to be with us for another year, but I can't imagine he'll be with us much longer than that. So part of that, I mean, that is our identity and our philosophy going in. And this year, notwithstanding the challenge that we're put in front of us, we brought along players. Louis Binks evolved as a player. Martial, who came in and only played a few games, showed an evolution. Amar Sejdic, who at the end of the year was clearly belonged in the starting 11. So you've seen a lot of these young players. Akiza comes in and hadn't played for a year, comes in the last game of the season and has an impact in the last 15 minutes, right? So these are signs that we are moving in the direction we want to be moving in. And I'm very encouraged about how this is going to look in 2021.
I mean, Kamal Miller liked that one. George Mihailovic, I am fascinated by that move.
They fit that mold.
I gotta end you on this one. I gotta go back to it. What do you think happens for this team as far as logistics in 2021? And what is a measure of success in 2021, given all the challenges?
Listen, what to expect? We have to expect everything going into 2021. Obviously, there's light at the end of the tunnel. We don't know how long that tunnel is, right? But I would like to think that as vaccinations progress in the U.S., the likelihood of having U.S. teams come here to play us becomes a more realistic possibility. Obviously, playing games at the stadium will be allowed. The NHL team has been allowed to play all of their home games at the Bell Center, which is an indoor stadium. So I'd like to think that at some point this season we will be bringing fans back in. But we have to be prepared for everything. We learned that last year. You can't sit there and assume that everything will go as planned. We're stronger coming off of last year, more prepared for this. But I'd like to think that this year will not be as taxing as it was last year.
Uncertainty, just part of all of our lives right now. But Club de Foot Montréal, did I get that a little bit better?
Club de Foot Montréal.
Montréal. See, it's that little bit of like back throat that I'm just, you know, I'm still struggling
with.
Don't
focus on the back throat. Say Club de Foot Montréal.
Montréal. Okay, that was not good either. I'm going to keep practicing, Kevin. I appreciate your time here, the president and CEO of CF Montréal. Thank you for your time, man, and good luck in 2021.
Thank you, Andrew.
All right, quick thoughts. Quick thoughts on the snowflake crest. Is that what the... Look, I'm not going to lie. First look at it, like, it comes... You open the file on your... it comes on Twitter or, you know, let's be honest, maybe it leaks. You take a look at it and you're like, I don't know. I was kind of attached to the Impact. And then I thought a little bit more and I was like, what is it about the Impact that is distinct other than it being there for a long time? And I couldn't really come up with it. It didn't really seem to me like, you know, on reflection, it truly represents sort of this awesome culture that I know we all love, and we love going to Montreal to games and for vacation and for whatever else to experience that city. I think if they can stay true to their desire and what they say this wants to should be and what they say they're representing and what Montreal really is, then this is a positive move for CF Montreal, which I'll have to get used to saying because I almost said the Impact there. So I personally like it. It's really grown on me. I like the snowflake. I like the metro side of it. I like all the logic behind it. But ultimately, like, as I said to Kevin Gilmore, you also have to win. That's a big part of your brand.
Yeah, my first reaction was, okay, I'm fine with this. Like, most of the time, my first reaction is, eh? And this one, I was like, oh, yeah. I think it's cool. I think it's a little unique. I like the colors, which is the biggest part, because that's what you're wearing all the time. That's what fans are wearing. That's what the stadium's covered in. So all of that works for me. And all of that's pretty similar to what the Impact look was. So I'm fine with that. To your point, I agree. I think there was nothing wrong with the Montreal Impact. There was nothing wrong with the name and the crest and all those things. But if you're going to change the team and be more successful now and you want to do this, fine. But the on-field stuff is what pretty much matters.
Doyle nods. Doyle nods. All right, maybe you have thoughts on this, Doyle. Colorado Rapids trade for Michael Barrios. Of course, FC Dallas just signed Hyder O'Brien, who is a right winger. And I wrote about this and I was like, I'm very interested to see how this goes because he's the second leading scorer in Colombia. A very recent sort of vintage goal scoring is for him as a player. But it seemed like there wasn't going to be a ton of room for both he and Barrios. And it turns out that's correct. Colorado get Barrios. They also get the 21st overall pick in the 2021 Super Draft, and then Dallas get an international roster spot, and then they swap picks. Basically, they get the 15th pick in this Super Draft. What do you think? He had a huge year 2 years ago. Last year, not quite so good, but we know who he is. We're familiar.
Yeah, and he's a guy who just hasn't delivered in the playoffs for Dallas, despite being a really good regular season player for a long time. But he also relies on his speed, and he's hitting 30 this year. And so I understand why Dallas decided to move on. I also understand, given Colorado's depth chart, why they decided this was the right move for them. Because despite his playoff struggles, players like Michael Barrios help get you through the season and get you to the playoffs. And that's what Colorado need to do. They need to get back to the playoffs again and hope that they have a difference maker who can get them a win in 2021. So it does make a lot of sense, I think, for both teams, though Dallas are right now a little bit thin on the wings. So I'd expect them to maybe make another move or two. And from what I heard, you could see it, the asking price from Colorado's point of view was super low, like an international roster spot, 15 and the 15th pick. For a veteran who can soak up 2,000 minutes and probably give pretty good minutes, even though last year was his worst year in MLS. It was a really janky and weird year, as we all know. I think this makes sense for both teams.
And we've seen when he's motivated, he's competitive. And as you said, he'll put up numbers in the regular season, which either lets Nomly play, whatever it is, you can move pieces around along that front line as you need to, if Lewis is gone or if Cole Bassett's gone, whatever it is. And he brings that. I think this is a win-win.
Absolutely. For both teams. I think if you look at the Rapids, we talked about them on the last couple of shows about the DP spots. We're like, hey, go sign a 9, go do this, that, and the other. I'm not sure that's who they think they are or will be. I mean, ultimately, there are teams that have different ways of going about it in MLS. They're not going to be Atlanta United. They're not going to be Toronto FC. No. They are going to try to be competitive in sort of like playing these moves on the edges, as we've talked about. You know, you'll go get a Kellen Acosta. You go get these guys that you know have value, but other teams maybe have kind of hit the end of the line with. And that's what they've done. And then they really are pushing the youth side of things with Bassett and Vines and a bunch of other guys, Sebastian Anderson being among them. They just re-signed Austin Trusty, Lalasso Babakar. So I think if you look at the Rapids, the one thing that we maybe forgot when we were talking about the DPs is that they still have got a ton of goals. You're looking at me funny here. Think back to post.
I just feel like you used the word we liberally.
Okay, me, fine.
Okay.
Yeah, fine. Me. That's a good correction. I appreciate your attention to detail and holding me accountable for my takes.
We are in favor of it.
They've scored a ton of goals without a DP9. They've scored their goals by committee. They're not a team that's like, hey, we need a guy scoring 25. They're a team that has said, we're fine with like five guys scoring 7 to 10 or 5 to 10 or whatever it is. Post Anthony Hudson, the point is, with the way they've built this roster, they've had a ton of success. Like top 5 points in the league, top 5 goals in the league success. So you can't ignore that. And again, Michael Barrios' contract's up at the end of the year, I believe. Super low risk for them. Mm-hmm. This is a guy who had 15 assists and 5 goals, I think, 2 years ago. So if you can get half that production and now you let Nomley play on the left and tuck in because you're vertical on the right, Keegan Rosenberry played a lot of sort of like 3-man back line at times, shifting in last year. Sam Vines flies forward. He fits into a lot of things of what you're doing, and he's not going to break your building model, which you're in right now. And you do what Doyle said, which is hopefully go back to the playoffs. I think they have the talent. I think that they have the coach. I think they have the locker room and sort of the chemistry, it seems like, to do that in MLS. It just, for them, it was a bummer last year that it got disrupted so many times by the current world that we're living in. How about Jorge Villafañe, Sueño to the Galaxy?
So Portland already brought in a big-time left back. They think he's going to be one of the best in the league. He's 23. So it makes sense that he would be out there and be available. And for the Galaxy, their back line's been terrible. So they go in, they go out, they get an MLS experience left back. I don't think he's one of the best in the league at that position, but he's not going to lose you games. If your setup is right and he's confident enough, he could win you some games pushing up from left back. And you get some stability for what was basically a first-round swap. They didn't even give up a first-round pick. They just swapped picks with Portland. And then based on production, they might have some allocation money going out, which every GM will tell you, if that's my setup, then I'm happy to give away the money because that means they played well and we did well. So I think this is another one. It made sense for both teams. For the Galaxy, they just need some MLS stability along the back line, and that's what he is.
Yeah, no, nothing to add to that.
Okay, that's we're running low on time, let's say, but not too low to give the mailbag its proper attention here. 401-206-0MLS, extra time at MLSsoccer.com. What do we got, Div?
So Austin in Fort Worth to start. He says, let's say our best players are released and they play in the Olympics if they happen. What 3 overage players would you bring for the U.S.? So in this scenario, Pulisic's a part of it. Weston's a part of it. Tyler's a part of it. So who would be the overage people?
Matthew Poppy.
Yeah.
Exactly. So you're stacked up. You basically have your first team in a lot of ways for the U.S., which, oh my God, if that actually happened, which, let's be honest, we got to qualify
it's
first. Let's start with that part of it.
We need to qualify, then they need to not go to Gold Cup and Nations League. And
exactly, but I think that might be the most excited I would be about a tournament in my entire life, World Cups included.
So who would be your 3?
I don't know the Olympics roster and the way it stands right now well enough to know where you would go. It would feel to me like goalkeeper would be an obvious spot.
You'd want to go with the number one goalkeeper, so it would be Matt Turner.
I knew right? Doyle was going to take that.
Set you up for that one. By the way, Matt Turner, undrafted in the Super Draft.
Yep.
Undrafted. Right. So see what you can do if you scout properly.
It would probably be Stefan, Brooks, and then maybe Legette or maybe Josie, yep. Right? Because Legette's still a starter right now. Judging by everything that is – happened with the national team over the past year, and even with so many of the young players playing so well for their clubs, Sebastian Legette still a starter for the national team at this moment. So there would be an argument for him, and then there would be an argument for Josie as a 25-minute a game super sub. I guess there's an argument for Jossie as well. Jossie's really good at what he does, but I would hope that, you know, be it Josh Sargent or Io or Daryl DK or Jeremy Abobase, I think they all have the talent to overtake Jossi, and that's not a shot at Jossi. That's me thinking the kids are really
all right. Let us know. Who would you bring in? What else we got?
So we got an email here that said, "Dear Extra Time, I wrote the win, draw, loss email you read last week and apologize for it.
No.
You generously set aside time for emails and I wasted it with the tongue-in-cheek nonsense that fell flat when read, which I feel like falls on me. So I'm giving him this one. I'm very sorry. This is not what our nation stands for now in this time. We need unity and healing. Sincerely, Eric Olson, the 2021 Pulitzer Prize winner for the win, draw, loss email."
That felt very serious in the moment. Yeah. And I took it seriously. And I was like, you know what? As a fellow pedantic person, I'm here for this. But you know what? Apology accepted, Eric.
A pedantic person is called a pedant.
Yeah, but I didn't want to screw that up. I didn't know what the exact one was. I thought I knew and I thought it was, but if I screwed it up, then I knew you'd come after me. So I tried to take the easy way out, and then you still came after me. So that is,
because I'm a very pedantic person.
Yes, you are.
Let's close out on this. A little help for Weeby. We got a bunch in the mailbag that says, "Tell Goss he's a moron for saying no one cares about KC. Also, KC, Kansas is 10 times better than Kansas City, Missouri." I didn't know what all the acronyms stood for.
Yeah, KCKS. I've never seen it written like that, but I've only been here for what, you know, like a month at this point. So the guy who lived
his whole life.
Yeah, but not here. I was here for like a year and a half maximum, man.
Oh, you were so far away in Lawrence and Wichita.
You know, the West Plaza and wherever it is I live now that I'm not going to share are very different, extremely different places. Anything else? Are we good to go?
No, that's it. You got
Anders saying to wrap the train wreck up.
Usually when he does that, we do the opposite. This time we're going to listen to him. All right, that's it for us. Big thanks to Chris Armas and Kevin Gilmore for joining us once again next week, next Thursday, the MLS Superdraft 2021 presented by Adidas, 2 p.m. Eastern on Thursday. You can watch that stream anywhere you get MLS content, Twitter, Facebook, YouTube, the site, Pluto TV, etc. Again, programming note for you, so don't tweet at us on Monday. Go enjoy your day. Tuesday and Friday for us. We will preview on Tuesday and review on Friday. And with that, enjoy your weekend, everybody.